The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly bonus Friday edition, because the fixtures made it that way. The Premier League, Chelsea unbeaten under Tuchel, Liverpool 5 defeats at home in a row. Spurs finally play all their attackers and grind out a scratchy 1-0 win at Fulham. Classic Jose, who's looking forward to another handball chat. Everton in grave danger of being too good for the Everton Cup. What happens then? Also, the cops in the Nou Camp. What's happening there? Sid joins to explain. We pay tribute to Ian St John, discuss the UK and Ireland 2030 World Cup, bringing football home, and look ahead to another weekend of endless football. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Hello, Jacob Steinberg.
Good morning.
Hi, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, Max Rushton.
Let's start at Anfield then. Liverpool nil, Chelsea 1. Liverpool lose at home for the fifth consecutive match. 10 games unbeaten for Thomas Tuchel. Jacob, you're the Guardian's Chelsea correspondent. How impressed have you been with the Tuchel revolution? How impressed were you with them last night?
Very impressed on both counts so far. The transformation since Frank Lampard left is obviously been very, very good. It's completely different to how it was before Tuchel arrived. You can see a proper structure in defence. They're very, very hard to get at now. They don't really concede any chances. They've barely conceded any goals. They've kept clean sheets against Tottenham, albeit a Tottenham side who didn't really attack and had no Harry Kane. But then they went to Atletico last week against a team at the top of the Spanish league and very easily kept a clean sheet, won that. Didn't really concede any chances against Manchester United on the weekend. And then last night, again, they never really looked like conceding. So it's been very impressive so far. You know, it kind of speaks volumes that one of the only goals they've conceded so far is just a calamitous own goal, a mix-up between Rudiger and Mendy in the Sheffield United game. So on that front, you know, the tactical shift to the back three, bringing in certain players who it suits, playing Azpilicueta as the right-sided centre-back, which has, ever since the Conte era, has been a position that really suits him. It's been a smart move, bringing back Rudiger, who was, you know, kind of an outcast until right at the end under Lampard. You know, he's been transformed as well. That back three as well suits certain players in the wing back positions and even the central midfielders. So on that front, it's been really impressive. It's been a little bit more of a slow work in progress going forward. They haven't always been that exciting at times, but I thought last night was much better. Again, maybe helped by Liverpool slightly playing into their hands with their high line against Timo Werner. And obviously Werner was very unlucky not to get that goal, which was ridiculously taken off by the offside call from VAR. Werner obviously as well, you saw the lack of confidence in that early chance he had, where he just, instead of just blasting it past Alisson, tries a really tame lob. So that's been a little bit of an issue so far in that they haven't always been able to create chances, which is something you saw in that very dull game with United. But again, there's more of an idea in attack, which you never really saw at the end, especially under Lampard, and particularly at times this season, where you felt like it was just a bit of a collection of very, very good individual players who were thrown together without much of a plan going forward. And that was obviously then seen in the performances. Whereas under Tuchel, you get a sense really of what he wants to do with the team, even if at times it's not quite working. It's been very good so far.
Lars, you get the impression that he's done it so quickly that does that mean he's a complete genius, Thomas Tuchel, or these changes should have been more obvious to Frank Lampard before?
I definitely think the point that Jacob makes, which I think is the key issue here with Chelsea, is the structure and how much the players seem to know where to stand now and where to be in relation to each other on the pitch. It is very, very impressive, I think, for a coach to come in and get that sorted so quickly, given that there's so little time on the training ground this time of year anyway, and doubly so with the COVID schedule. There was always something about Chelsea under Frank Lampard that, let's be serious about it, they did have certain games where they played very well, but there was always something sort of chaotic about it that I found slightly uneasy watching, and it was sometimes hard to put your finger on it. But because they were the opposite of this, they were a team who, even when they were playing well, there would be huge gaps, you know, and there would be the, what's that player doing over there? And like, this guy's run over here, and it's like, what's happening now? And whereas now, it is much more structured and controlled, and there'll be certain games I expect against defensive opponents who are happy to let sort of Kante and Jorginho ping the ball back and forth between them. They might struggle to carve them open, and there might be a few of those games. And I still wonder if there could be a looming sort of Sarri-style culture war there about too many sideways passes coming down the pipeline. But in this game against Liverpool, who offered them so much space to attack, obviously that wasn't a problem.
Mason Mount, Barry, I can't work out if he is appreciated the right amount by everyone. Is he still underrated because he's not quite as wispy as Jack Grealish? Or is he wispier than Jack Grealish? Either way, you know, and Phil Foden and that. Am I appreciating Mason Mount enough?
Well, I keep hearing that Mason Mount is underrated, and I'm not sure by whom he is underrated. I don't think he's as naturally talented as Phil Foden or Jack Grealish, but he's a terrific footballer. He does what he's told, which is, you know, brilliant for a manager. He's really reliable. And as I say, I keep hearing that he's underrated, but who is underrating him? His managers don't underrate him. I don't think Chelsea fans underrate him. All I ever hear from pundits is that he's excellent. So who is it that underrates him?
I think there's a certain place on social media where you'll find Mason Mount quite underrated, and you know, there's all the kind of teacher's bet stuff with Frank Lampard. You know, he was Frank Lampard's son, but now he appears to also be Thomas Tuchel's son as well. I also saw it when the October England internationals, where he played him again, where Southgate played him against against Belgium at home, and he played him instead of Jack Grealish, I think Sterling was out, and there's kind of that outcry at that time of, God, it's just a defensive change from Gareth Southgate, you know, playing Mount, and it's really not. It's just because he works hard off the ball that gets this impression that he's just a bit of a workhorse, but he's not. He's very technically gifted. And at the same time, there was always that, it became a bit of a running joke that every time anybody asked Southgate about how well Jack Grealish maybe played in a friendly, he sort of go, yeah, he was good, but also let's talk about how good Mason Mount was. And it sort of becomes that, it gets an impression at times that he's a bit of a teacher's pet, but it's just because he's got a great attitude. So that's where it comes from.
Isn't that basically the Sean Dyche protocol now? I mean, I think you are legally obliged to mention how underrated he is every time you talk about him. And when that gets mentioned enough times, surely it just becomes meaningless.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Timo Werner, I thought, Jacob, was really good last night. And I know I feel the goals will come. And I think even if he doesn't score for years and years to come, I'll keep saying, I think the goals will come for Timo Werner.
Yeah, he was good in playing up front, which he hasn't done that much this season, through the middle. And under Frank Lampard, he was often played as a left winger in a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1, which more or less doesn't suit him because he was way too out wide. And sometimes there were times, I think, when he played as a right winger as well, which again just meant that he's going away from goal. That shift to the back three really suits him because he gets him playing in that position that he was playing for Leipzig last season, you know, as a kind of inside left off a target man. Last season it was Patrick Schick for Leipzig. This season it's at times it's been Giroud, at times it's been Tammy. But last night, you know, playing as through the middle, he really gave them a lot of problems with the pace. His finishing is really erratic and very amusing at times. He, you know, that the one where he managed to clear it off the goal line against Leeds will probably go down as the miss of the season. And last night as well, as I said before, the early miss was very very disappointing. And but he does sort of affect things. He's not kind of in that Morata Torres zone of just being just a really sad, miserable presence up front. He is doing things for the side as well. He's causing teams a lot of problems, and probably that movement that he was offering them up front probably played a part as well in the Mount goal, because he really spooked Liverpool with how he was able to get in behind them.
Liverpool have scored one first half goal in their last 12 Premier League games. They've gone more than 10 hours without a goal in open play at Anfield. Barney writing, 68 without defeat at home into 5 in a row of losses. This really is wild. No matter what we throw at it, football remains the most brilliantly unknowable of human activities. I mean, it is bonkers that they've lost 5 games in a row at home.
Well, it's unprecedented. It's never happened before. And it's remarkable. If you had said to me at the start of the season, at some point Liverpool will lose 5 home games in a row, I'd have laughed you out the gate. Their confidence seems shot. Much has been made of their problems in defence and the injuries in defence, but they have a lot of problems going forward. And the sight of Jurgen Klopp substituting Mo Salah last night was weird, because you'd think if you're struggling to get goals, he is the one guy who is going to provide that spark of magic to get you a goal. And obviously he was very, very unhappy about being taken off, sitting there shaking his head and looking morose. And I believe his Mr. 15% has already put out some sort of statement or other voicing the dissatisfaction. But the Liverpool are a bit of a mess at the moment. I was surprised last night to see, and I know it's formed by the market, but Liverpool were quite hot favourites to win that game last night, and I was baffled. But you know, why would they be favourites to win a game against Chelsea? Then they barely laid a glove on them. I think they had one shot on target. That was it. At home,
Lars. It's unthinkable that they wouldn't be in the Champions League. But you know, if their form continues like this, they won't be in the Champions League next year.
Yeah, no, and I think. There are a couple of facets here. One of them is like the psychology is starting to become an issue. I mean, surely confidence is a thing now. And we were just mentioning with Timo Werner, who has been amusingly inept in front of goal at times this season. I think he's a case study of how, as much as we like believe in numbers and analytics and stuff increasingly, like the psychological side of it is huge. Because he obviously, you know, scored 28 goals last season for RB Leipzig. It's not just he scored goals, but a lot of them were like brilliantly executed technical finishes, which if you'd only seen him this season, you think is surely not something that can ever have happened. But it did. And there's like the mental side of it is huge. But I just also think with Liverpool, if you break it down a bit and you ask sort of Jurgen Klopp, what's the sort of central tenet of his sort of football? What does he believe in the most? I think he'd probably say that the high press, you know, the winning the ball high up the field, the gegenpressing. I mean, he famously said that there's no playmaker as good as a good counter-pressing situation or something, right? So if you want to press high up the field, and if that's a huge part of what you do, what do you need to be able to do that? Well, you need to keep a high line defensively, because if not, you become too stretched and there's too much space to play between you. So you need a defense that's capable and comfortable of playing with a very high line. Do they have that right now? You're playing with the 57th centre-back pairing of the season, one of who is like a small child they signed from Schalke, who's mainly been losing games of football for the last 18 months. I'm sure Kaba could become a very good centre-half, but asking him to play with like this perilously high line in the Premier League is a big ask right now, especially when he's playing next to a converted centre midfielder. It was almost comical the way, I think Barney touched on it in his piece, how he could just play the really fast guy up front and lob balls in behind and just destroy them like that. It's kind of like amusingly Sunday League type of football. So you don't really have that. The other thing you need to do to play like that is you need a ton of energy across the field, because you have to keep pressure on the man in possession. Like if you're going to defend that high, which you need to if you want to win the ball that high, then you cannot let the opponent sort of pick you off and play passes in behind. And to do that, you need just an abundance of energy to put pressure on them. And no one has that this season, which is why Man City had to change the way they're playing, which we've talked about a lot of times, I'm sure, on the pod. They're pressing less than before. They're keeping the team more compact than before. And this is Guardiola, who also is a sort of win the ball high up the field guy, but he's looked at it and just realized, actually, we can't do that this season. It just isn't possible. We have to do things differently. And Klopp as amazing a job as he has done at Liverpool, he seems to be trying to play the exact same way they have been playing for the last couple of years. I'm not sure it's possible right now.
While we're on Liverpool, we should pay tribute to Ian St. John. He's died at the age of 82, was a pivotal figure in the restoration of the club, leading force in the mid-60s, scoring and making goals in a partnership with Roger Hunt that brought three major honours to Anfield. He won 21 caps for Scotland as well, scoring nine times. Was a hero at Motherwell as well. And he went on to become part of one of the greatest double acts in sort of football broadcasting with Jimmy Greaves. And they broadcast for about a decade, I think, that show. And for people of sort of my age, our age, I'd say, you know, Jacob and Barry, I don't know if Saint and Greavesy made it to Norway, Lars, but it was kind of pioneering television, Barry, in the terms of making football fun and not taking football so sort of so earnestly and seriously as it had always been taken before. And was a sort of precursor to all the fun football TV and radio shows and probably influenced this pod in some way.
Well, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the Saint. I was obsessed with Saint and Greavesy. I loved it. And I was more interested in watching them than I was in the football they were talking about. But watching them got me sort of obsessed with football. So if it wasn't for them, I don't think Football Weekly would even exist, possibly. And if it did exist, I certainly wouldn't be on it. And many people may think, oh, damn you, Saint. Damn you, Greavesy. And obviously, Max, you are living proof that presenting a pre-lunchtime Saturday light entertainment football show is nowhere near as easy as Saint made it look. But they were kind of like the Morecambe and Wise of football light entertainment. And Saint, while in the role of the straight man, was a very funny guy. And he had a very infectious laugh, and he just exuded warmth. So I think we owe him a lot. I don't think Soccer AM would ever existed, or fantasy football. You mentioned this in the WhatsApp group. I don't think they would have existed without Saint and Greavesy.
No, I think you're probably right. And it's, you know, what a great thing to have. You know, people might not like all those shows, but just the fact that you can love sport but not treat it like it's, you know, life or death is a great thing. And I think they were and the producers of that show as well, the people that gave them the freedom to do it as well, you know, deserve a huge amount of credit. And a wonderful footballer as well. Kenny Dalglish tweeted, "R.A.P. Saint Ian St. John was instrumental in making Liverpool FC the club it is today. I think it's right to use the word icon. I'm sure he knew that when he was here. The club really appreciated and revered him for what he did for us. Long may he be remembered for all the happy memories he's given to the fans." Let's go to Craven Cottage. Fulham 0, Spurs 1. Bale and Ali started. Ali's second Premier League start of the season. The other was the opening day, along with Harry Kane and Heung-min Son. Did it work, Jacob?
For the first half, it worked, definitely. It turns out that Dele Alli is quite a good player in the number 10 role. I think he's, for what he offers them on the ball, is probably more than Lamella and Lucas Moura offer. Although I do quite like Eric Lamella for his snideness, and also he can be quite effective at times, especially when he's kind of riding through challenges. But I think I definitely think he offers more than Lucas Moura. It's just being obviously that issue around the amount that he works off the ball, maybe the application at times from in training, which obviously well documented in the documentary by Jose Mourinho. I think it was something by the end that Pochettino was worried about with Dele Alli. So I don't think it's always necessarily been just look at Jose on this and put the blame on him. I think there are probably areas where Dele Alli himself needs to improve, and there are probably players, you know, in his position, those number 10 roles, English players, those young English players who are maybe doing more off the ball than him now. People like Madison, Foden, Mason Mount, as we've discussed, and Dele Alli maybe needs to catch up to them, but he's still very effective in the penalty area. You know, that when he initially broke through, it was in the great seasons that he had. He was scoring almost 20 goals a season, almost playing as a striker alongside Harry Kane when Tottenham under Pochettino were going for the title. So I think it shouldn't be a big surprise that Dele Alli can be effective. And the same applies to Gareth Bale, who, although they lost that game to West Ham a couple of weeks ago, suddenly when he came on at half-time, looked just totally different and kind of terrifying in the moments when he was able to find some space. And I don't think last night was quite at that level. But, you know, again, with that front four, you would think that Tottenham should probably be able to produce a lot more. I think the worry for them is that second half performance is one that we've seen before. I've seen it quite a few times with Tottenham where they can start quite well because they've got very good attacking players. And it looks pretty good for 20 minutes, half an hour. They take the lead often against a smaller side. And then it just kind of starts to drift and they start to seem to forget how to play. They drop back and they start to rely on a defence that isn't particularly good anymore. And, you know, a debate that was had quite forcibly on Sky the other day. And then we saw it against Palace away, where they went into that game top of the league in December, which the game that kind of started it all, late equaliser, Liverpool late winner from Liverpool, more games like that. Fulham in January, they got a late equaliser at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, and they were unlucky again not to get it. It's only because of a ridiculous handball or that they don't get an equaliser that they deserve. There was a very lucky moment for Matt Doherty late on with where he puts the ball past his own post. And those are the kind of margins that you're dealing with Tottenham at times where we can talk about a hard-fought win because that's what they've got in the end, but also it's very marginal between that being a hard-fought win or just two more drop points. And you kind of feel that when they come up against better teams, this is going to be an issue.
It'll be interesting to see if it worked well enough for Mourinho to persevere with it. You mentioned that handball. Fulham can be frustrated. It is the law. Scott Parker said, "I'm complaining at the rule. We want it to be the most entertaining league in the world with goals. I don't know what Lamina can do. We just need some common sense." The common sense klaxon. "We're trying to make football so pure and sterile it becomes unrealistic." Paddy writes to the pod, "Should footballers, keepers excepted, be allowed to have arms? What Lamina failed to do was move his arm into an unnatural position, and then it wouldn't have hit him in the arm, and then it wouldn't have been disallowed. As opposed to if he'd been defending, then he wants to keep his arm in a natural position at all times. You've got to remember which penalty area you're in. IFAB are having a meeting today, everyone, which is exciting, isn't it? Further clarification on the handball law before next season is expected to be discussed. Peter Walton. He said on the telly yesterday, handball is number 6 on the agenda. Wow, all to be a fly on the wall in this meeting.
What are items 1 to 5?
Well, I don't know what items 1 to 5 are, but anyway.
I mean, we laugh, but at a time when referees are being pilloried and abused and getting death threats, it's so unfair on, I think it was David Coote was the ref game. It's so unfair on him because there are going to be people, a lot of people watching football don't know the laws of the game, and they're going to pin that one on him. That's his fault. He's made a mistake. And he hasn't made a mistake. He has followed the law to the letter and disallowed a goal, which realistically should be allowed. And so he's going to get pilloried and abused by Fulham fans and other people who were watching the game for something that is nothing to do with him, that is not his fault, and it's not good enough. I think it should be moved up the agenda.
VAR is the consequence of us, of people on social media, on post-match punditry and everything with the massive focus on referees. It's basically our punishment for microscopically challenging every decision, and when... This is what we get, basically. We deserve it.
I don't think anybody thinks that goal should be disallowed. I just don't think anybody does.
This can be a mercifully short conversation. It's a really dumb law, and it should be changed.
Yeah. Thank you, Lars.
End of conversation. Like, we can move on.
Once again, Fulham quite good. Don't get what they deserve from the game and need to score goals. Our Fulham chat is becoming more copy and paste than our Newcastle chat, isn't it?
But it's worth, sorry for budging in, but I think I want to give Scott Parker some credit, even though they've lost, because I watched Fulham a bit last season when they were on their way up. They're one of the teams I go to as a punter occasionally when we were allowed to do that. And I wasn't a huge fan because I thought there was a lot of sterile possession, a lot of sort of Tom Kearney, you know, playing sideways passes, and a lot of teams not going anywhere. So I thought when they went up, like, I'm not sure. And then they started the season not very well at all. And we thought, oh God, this is going to be a catastrophe. And it feels like a season that could have very easily spun out of control into some sort of catastrophic death spiral for them. But I think Parker's done a really good job rejigging the team and keeping it from spinning out of control and turning it into a team that is competitive in most of the games they played. And they've had so many games this winter where they should have gotten more than they had. And I feel really sorry for them at this point. And I still think they can stay up just because Newcastle are quite dreadful.
And just, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think they have got more chance than Newcastle staying up at the moment. West Brom lost to Everton last night. It was pretty even. They had that goal disallowed late on. It was a pretty tight game, but another win for Everton. They're in a really good position, Lars.
Yeah, I mean, Ancelotti has done a very good job. And I mean, there's a manager who is not wedded to one particular way of playing. He's more than happy to change formations according to which players are in form and what he's up against. And I think it's a good season for that kind of pragmatism because no one's going to be at their best at any point. I think with this game, I mean, it was only temporary, but very, very briefly, Big Sam did achieve his ambition of getting Everton into the top four, which I think was a good moment for him. His joy was short-lived, of course. He is definitely not bitter about what happened at Everton, Big Sam. I'll say that for him. The interviews this week has shown he's completely over it and he doesn't think about it at all.
Well, well done to Everton. And that'll do for part one. Sid joins us in just a second and we'll find out what's going on at Barcelona. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Sid Lowe. Hello, Sid Lowe.
Hi, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you.
Excellent news. What's happening at Barcelona? A number of arrests made on Monday after searching offices at the club. No details released about how many people have been detained or their identities, with a Catalan police spokesperson only revealing that the raid followed an investigation by the force's financial crimes unit. Is this a huge story, or is this just a sort of accountants-based admin story?
It's kind of both things. It's huge because of what's behind it. It is an accounting admin thing, but we don't know the full extent of that yet, and it could be far worse. It could be a case of corruption. There's certainly ethical questions wrapped up in it, even if they're not necessarily legal questions. And you said that the identities weren't confirmed. They weren't publicly or officially confirmed, but we're talking about the former president of the club, José María Bartomeu. We're talking about his advisor, his kind of right-hand man, Jaume Mas Ferrer. We're talking about the club's current CEO, and we're talking about the club's head of legal. So these are four, this is, if you like, the core of the people running the club at that point. I'm going to try and keep this as simple as I possibly can. This goes back to a case that was uncovered by Cadena Ser Radio in Barcelona, who had discovered that Barcelona had paid an internet monitoring service to basically obviously watch what was being said on social media, also to launch a series of SOC, I believe they're called SOC accounts or SOC puppet accounts, that would have basically fake Twitter accounts having a go at various opposition figures, defending the reputation of the president and some of the people that were kind of in their line of fire, included current players, Messi, Gerard Piqué, former players, Xavi Hernandez, Pep Guardiola, one or two others. I think actually, if you look at the content of those tweets, it's largely pretty innocuous stuff. But of course, there is that question about, so club resources were used to effectively defend a person, albeit that person is the president, but a person, not the club as an institution, and to attack people who are related to clubs. There's all sorts of ethical questions bound up in that. The next thing that this led us to was that the amount of money paid was, this was the accusation, and six directors basically resigned off the back of this, was overpaid, and also that the payments to that company were split. A total of around about €1 million in the first round of payments split, so that all of those payments were under €200,000. So what, you might ask? Well, if it's under €200,000, it doesn't automatically trigger the club's internal audits, the club's internal process of protection, and it means it doesn't go to the board. In other words, this is a small nucleus within the club who did this without other elements of the club knowing and finding out. At the time, what Barcelona did was, and here's the next question, they sacked their compliance officer, the woman who was investigating this. They then asked PricewaterhouseCoopers to come up with an internal audit. They said, look, they're going to investigate it. And PricewaterhouseCoopers came back and said there was no corruption. No one had their hand in the till. There wasn't any individual benefiting from this. Although we do question the way in which the invoices were divided up. And so essentially that's led to a fans group asking for this to be investigated by the police doing so, and then going into the club back in July, I think it was, to pick up documents, and then doing again that on Monday, going into the club. They were there for 6 or 7 hours, picking up documentation, taking away computers, all that kind of stuff, and then making arrests, bringing people in to speak to the investigating magistrate. Obviously, legal systems are different in England and Spain, but they're always referred to as a judge. It's an investigating judge, effectively an investigating magistrate, and police. So where this goes now, we don't know, because of course the fact that it's got this far, and I must admit, on a legal level and a financial level, there's a bit of me that thinks this is quite small fry, given how much money moves around in football. But maybe other things are being found as they pull at the threads. And one of the things that certainly is coming out over the last couple of days is that initial idea that no, there wasn't any attempt to defame anyone, there wasn't any attempt to damage the reputation of anyone, there are now testimonies saying actually that was exactly the attempt. So there's an ethical question there. And now the doubt about where did that money go? Who are these companies? And why are they the companies chosen for this to be the case? Obviously, presumption of innocence, but let's see how this plays out now.
Sid, just while you're talking there, I'm going, what is illegal here? Is it fraud?
The legal question now focuses on what's being referred to as administración desleal. In other words, you as individuals are, what would you call it? Malmanagement, bad management of club resources. The question of who is benefiting from this. In other words, is someone at the club benefiting from the fact that this contract goes to this particular company with club money, and is there maybe some sort of kickback at some point? But yes, Baz, in terms of the legality of this, is yes, the accusation would be mismanagement of club funds and potential corruption. And the key phrase is this: corruption amongst particulares. In other words, the victim of the corruption would be the club.
So on Monday, Barcelona said in a statement that they had offered up their, quote, full collaboration to the legal and police authorities to help make clear facts which are subject to investigation. It carried on, the information and documentation requested by the judicial police force relates strictly to the facts relative to this case. FC Barcelona expressed its utmost respect for the judicial process in place and for the principle of presumed innocence for the people affected within the remit of this investigation. Mm. We should also say that Barcelona denies any wrongdoing with regards to the social media accounts publishing negative material. And finally, that since Monday, all four individuals have been released. On the pitch, Sid, it inspired them, or perhaps had no relation to, had absolutely no connection to an amazing comeback in the Copa del Rey semi-final.
It absolutely did inspire them. Did you not see at the end of the game they were celebrating by jumping around chanting fuck the police? That was what happens obviously in the cup game is that Gerard Piqué scores with the last touch of the game of normal time to take it into extra time. Martin Braithwaite scores to win 3-0, having lost the first leg 2-0. You look at their cup run this season, Barcelona, it's been extraordinary. They needed extra time against third tier Cornea in the first round. They needed two goals to come back against second-tier Rayo Vallecano in the next round. They needed a goal in the 88th and 93rd minute to take the game against Granada into extra time. They then went into the lead. Granada scored again. They needed another two to win that. And now they have this. And there is a sense, I think, that this is creating a certain degree of community and communion within the team. The buildings of actually a team now. It's certainly reinforced Koeman's position. Gerard Piqué had said at the weekend that if they were to turn this round, it would change their entire season, not just in the Cup, but in the league as well. Note that he didn't say in the Champions League. I think everyone accepts now that the Champions League has gone. And there is something building with Barcelona. I might have the stats wrong, but I think I'm right in saying that they haven't lost in La Liga. They've only lost once, I think, in La Liga in 15 games. Admittedly, they got taken apart by Paris Saint-Germain. But I think there's a belief in Spain that Europe is kind of another step again. You know, that's sort of a reality that has to be accepted. But that maybe now Barcelona can fight for not just the Copa del Rey, where they're playing against Athletic Bilbao, who brilliantly are now going to play two cup finals in 15 days. Not just the Copa del Rey, but maybe they can compete for the league. Although a lot of that will depend on what happens in the Madrid derby on Sunday.
And how happy is Messi?
Well, Messi looks very happy. You know, he was leading the chance of que se jode la policía.
Sid, I missed this because I was watching, you know, English stuff. But can you explain to us?
You see, that's your first mistake.
Yeah, I know,
right?
Yeah. It was it wasn't the right decision on that night. But can you explain to us what happened in extra time? Because just looking at the cards and the stuff, we had 1, 2, 3 yellow cards for Sevilla, 1 red card for Luke de Jong, who wasn't on the pitch, and a yellow card for Luke Bategui. Did everyone just go completely mad at the same time?
Sort of. I think you look at the number of cards and it sort of looks a little bit madder than it perhaps really was. By the way, I'm not sure it was for Lopetegui. I think it was for his assistant. Yeah. But as usual, you know, the referee's waving a card in the rough direction of the bench and no one knows absolutely for certain who it was for. So you've got De Jong misses a penalty, which is what obviously puts Barcelona in the position with 20 minutes to go, puts Barcelona in a position that they can take it to extra time. In extra time, there's then a big handball shout for a potential handball from Clement Longley. The referee is there with his finger in his ear for a very long time. And I love the fact the referee's got his fingers in his ears. Everyone's shouting at him. He's like, look, I'm trying to listen to this. Will you sod off? That obviously created a confrontation. Lots of things said. Luke de Jong on the touchline was one of the ones who said something. So it was really just a response to that. There was a second yellow card for Fernando for the foul on Trincao, I think, which led to the free kick just before the end, which led to the final goal. So one of them is just a second yellow card for a normal foul, but the other's yellow for complaints, basically. And there's been a suggestion that there were some confrontations in the tunnel afterwards with Sevilla's sporting director, Monchi, not least because Monchi at the weekend, when a decision had gone Barcelona's way, shouted from the stands, and obviously in an empty stadium you can hear it, you see, that goes to show that being a crybaby has an effect, because Koeman had complained about the referees the day before.
Sid, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. I'll try and learn to speak English next time.
And next time is Tuesday, by the way.
Is it? I think next time might not be Tuesday.
Oh.
I've got a horrible feeling I've got a dentist appointment, but I will check that for you.
Sounds like you've made
that. Can we do it while you're at the dentist?
Sounds like you've made that up, Sid.
No, I genuinely
have. Try to get out of this.
You have Sid on the happy guess.
I really should have, you know, done this a very, very long time ago. But now that bits of my teeth are falling out, I should probably actually go and do it.
We don't need to do this admin of who's on the pod. I mean, I'm happy to.
Except that last time I thought you were doing admin, you went and bloody put it on the pod and I look like an absolute moron. So yes, I should learn to keep my mouth shut, shouldn't I?
But not at the dentist, Sid.
No. Yeah. Cheers, Sid.
Cheerio. Speak to you later. See you.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. That'll do for part two. We'll be back looking ahead to the World Cup 2030, bringing football home. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. John says, is Barry backing the UK and Ireland bid for World Cup 2030? Will he get behind the proposal from Daniel McDonnell on Off the Ball to build a stadium in Barack Obama Plaza in Offaly? Although Daniel McDonnell replied, behave yourself. So every chance Daniel did not propose this. Barry, are you in? You and us together.
I actually know Daniel well. He's a very nice fellow, writes football for the Irish Independent and does horse racing. So I suspect he's had a very busy week, what with Gordon Elliott and news of this British and Irish bid. But I would be wholeheartedly in favour of a giant Enormo Dome being built anywhere in Offaly. It's a facility we don't have and could do with. And once the World Cup is over in 2030, we could just use it for something useful like playing hurling in. But I don't know what to make of this bid, really. It seems a bit half-arsed, and I suspect it was just a cynical PR exercise on the part of Boris Johnson to divert attention away from the austere budget, which was being announced the next
day. Boris Johnson revealed plans to, quote, bring football home. Is there a worse phrase he could have used? Get football done. Give us our ball back. With a joint UK and Republic of Ireland bid for the World Cup in 2030. The English FA said on Twitter it welcomed the government's pledge of £2.8 million towards a potential bid for the World Cup. A joint statement...
It's not a lot of money, is it? I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money in terms of launching a World Cup bid. It just seems like chump change.
But what are they... I mean, to launch the bid, what do you have to do? Just send a tweet? I mean, I'd do it for less than £2.8 million if they wanted me to tweet it. Here's a statement from the FA and Football Associations of Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland on Monday. The football associations and government partners of the UK and Ireland delighted that the UK government has committed to support a prospective five association bid for the 2030 FIFA World Cup. I don't know, Euro 96 was great, Jacob, wasn't it? Like, it'd be great to have it.
Sorry, before you, Jacob, steps in, Euro 96 was not great. Let's nip that in the bud. It was poorly attended.
Really?
Apart from England, a lot of games could not give tickets away. That obviously wouldn't happen now because everyone loves the England football team now. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's okay. No. Are you, Jacob, how do you feel? Would you like it?
I would like it, yes, but I don't think we'll get it. So, yeah, I read that it's going to be the 100-year anniversary of the first World Cup, isn't it, that was in
Uruguay.
So isn't it going to go there, probably?
So Uruguay are going in with I was chatting to Tim Vickery, who said basically only Montevideo could have games in Uruguay, so that they would do it joint with...
Argentina.
Chile, Argentina, and one other country, I forget. My apologies to our South American listeners in that country.
I think that England would probably host a good World Cup because the stadiums are good and probably quite capable of doing so. The Champions League finals that have been held here and also the Millennium Stadium have been well received, haven't they? People have liked going to those, but it seems like for some reason that I can't quite put my finger on that people don't really like Britain, so... Might be a problem.
You get it from Eurovision, don't you? Is it from Eurovision that you... That's when it really hits.
I don't know why. I don't know why people don't like us, but it seems like they don't. Maybe Lars can fill it in.
No, I don't. We're pretty lovable. Lars, do you like us or not?
You know, the words that our esteemed Prime Minister used, I thought was interesting. You know, we want to bring football home.
It's our game. We invented it. We gave it to all the people. Without us,
I mean,
it would never have happened.
What were the sort of rejected... phrases they considered for this, like "fuck you, peasants." I mean, that it was very good of them not to include that. I guess I don't know. It's just listen. It's this kind of sort of arrogance and entitlement that I think doesn't do them any favors. And that's not the only reason why they haven't won the bids in the past. I mean, we can have a very long and very lawyered pod about the process leading up to the votes.
So do you think we should have it should be much more understated, like England and Ireland and Scotland and Wales 2030 will give it a go? Or
if you were serious about it.
We're happy to host.
If you're serious about it, like it would be, there's a different way of talking about this, but I don't think he is serious about it. I think whipping up a bit of nationalism through a sort of half-assed World Cup bid that is eventually sort of denied at the polls at FIFA by smelly foreigners. I think that sort of suits Boris's agenda quite well.
Interestingly, some anti-nationalism then in Norway, where they're trying to boycott the World Cup with their morals and things, which is a joke that Barry put on the WhatsApp group. I should credit you there, Baz.
Oh, you can have it. It wasn't that funny.
This is really interesting, though. You know, lots of clubs starting with Tromso, and it's sort of snowballed from there, urging the Norwegian FA to boycott the Qatar World Cup in 2022.
Yeah, there seems to be a real sort of grassroots movement towards that. And I use the word grassroots very clearly, because the Norwegian FA, the leadership, is still that they don't believe a boycott is the right way to go. But Norwegian football still is sort of notionally a democracy. So what we're seeing is the Tromsø have came out in favour of a boycott, as has Strømsgodset, Odd Grenland, Brann, and now last night Rosenborg. And I think the Rosenborg one is quite quite worth noting, obviously, because they're arguably the biggest club in the country, but also the leadership at Rosenborg they went into their AGM last night with, you know, the official position from the leadership being that they didn't believe boycott was the right thing to do, but the members voting it through anyway, which is something that could happen. The Norwegian FA are having their big sort of AGM thing on the 14th, I believe it is. And it is possible that the delegates will vote in favor of some kind of boycott, whether the Norwegian FA leadership likes it or not. So there is a real sense that this is coming from the fans, from the people, more so than from the leaders themselves.
All right, thank you, Lars. And we will definitely cover it in more detail on a later pod. Quite tricky gear change from that to the discussion of uppity puppies, but that's the way it's gone. Patty Barry, very pleased, overwhelmed with the kindness shown by Barry. 7+ uppity puppies at mates rates. Thanks to Max for making it all happen. Jonathan says, FFS, now the phrase uppity puppy no longer has meaning. I mean, I don't know if it ever really had a lot of meaning in the first place. And I forget who sent me a message, but somebody whose English isn't their first language thought uppity puppy was one word and didn't know what uppity puppy was. But Barry, if you could just define uppity puppy, since it came from you, for our foreign listeners.
Well, I can't remember the context in which I used it originally, but the literal definition of an uppity puppy, I suppose, is a young dog that has notions above its station.
Thank you very much. I add it more down as a sad puppy, but I didn't understand it either. I'm getting Mr. Sad and Mr. Uppity muddled up. Was Mr. Sad a Mr. Man? I forget. Anyway, I should finish the pod. I've had quite a few, Jacob losing the will to live here. I've had quite a few messages, such as this one from fake Don Walker, just simply said, sorry about your wife, mate. It's probably worth clarifying that when Barry says your wife has left you, I'm very much under the impression she's returning. I believe... I'm quietly confident that my wife hasn't left me. But somebody also sent me a screen grab of a WhatsApp conversation between two listeners where they were debating whether my wife had actually left me or not left me.
So to be clear, you are under the impression she is on holidays in Australia, but yes, very much coming back.
I believe
she's... How long has she been there?
2 months now.
It's a long holiday.
Yes, I mean, I would say it's more... you know, visiting family.
Was it scheduled to be this long?
Yes. Yes. Mm. Well, it was extended once.
Was it now?
Yeah. Interesting.
Interesting.
And to be clear, she is returning on my birthday.
Yes, that's... Yes. But
am I picking her up at the airport or are you?
She's returning on your birthday to our house, not to your house.
Well, we'll see about that, won't we?
Lars, thank you for your time.
Anytime, Max.
Jacob, thank you.
Thank you.
Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.